I'm just curious if anybody had any observations or experiences with the meditation that they wanted to share. Was it loud? Could you all hear it? Okay. I was curious, did you recognize like the constituent parts of it, what it was based on as far as the four foundations of mindfulness? When I heard it, because he was really talking about the Satipatthana Sutta, the breath part was really clear and the mindfulness of the posture that he started with and the mindfulness of the body, and then he went into some of the other dimensions of the Satipatthana Sutta, the mind and the senses. The thing I was really not sure about when I first heard it was, where did he get all that happiness? Because the feeling in the Satipatthana Sutta is like mindfulness of feelings is really the Vedanas. It's pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And actually Allison had shared with me a link to a really nice lecture on the jhanas by Lee Brazington. And in that, what he talked about was that in the jhanas that you remove your mind from the sense gates, and that the concentration, it's like the mind removed, that quiet of the mind and the mind being removed from all of the input. We had a great example of sound meditation. Was that the mind, like as it concentrates and as it focuses, and this was something I really didn't know, that focus is what's pleasurable. And the pleasure of the concentrated mind, initially you're concentrating on your breath for long enough to get concentrated, and he called that access concentration. But then what gets generated is rapture, which is something in Pali called piti, and sukha, which is happiness. And it's the rapture and happiness that's really specific to the concentrated mind. And then once that's generated, that's actually what we concentrate on, are those pleasurable sensations. And so what I was realizing is that he wove into that meditation the happiness and the pleasure was from the concentrated mind. And so it was just a way of focusing on those pleasurable sensations that the concentration practice generates. And kind of after I listened to that, I was listening to a Thich Nhat Hanh meditation through Sounds True recordings. It was called A Day of Mindfulness. And Thich Nhat Hanh had a meditation that was almost, it was very similar to this, and including almost their tone of voice. And one of the things I was thinking is there's ways in which Analia sounds like a student of Thich Nhat Hanh's, with the gathas of the breathing in, I feel, the breathing out, I feel. So there were similarities, and all of a sudden I realized that I was starting to listen to a guided meditation and be familiar with the streams and the teachings and the lists from which it was drawn, which was really new for me. I mean, I'd never, you know, so I've sort of had this, what do you want to say, passive consumer relationship to Dharma talks and Dharma meditations, which is I hear them, I don't really analyze them. And this, I don't know, it wasn't analysis, but it was like, oh. And there's something for me, because the Satipatthana Sutta is said to be the direct path to awakening, that I started really taking it seriously. Huh, okay, well, if that's like the most direct path, what's this about? So I've been spending some more time with it. And then I wanted to just share with you a little bit, because I got to understand what the Buddha, the neuroscience that the Buddha was applying in the Satipatthana Sutta in choosing those things when I went through the medical neuroscience course. But before I do that, I just wondered, has anybody taken the 32 parts of the body meditation with Bob Stahl? I got to do the first time that was ever taught in the United States a number of years ago. And one of the reasons that I did it was I I really like body meditation. So one of the traditions in the mindfulness of the body in the Satipatthana Sutta is as mindfulness of the body comes out of a lineage that Goenka and Ubakim, which was the body scan, and then Jon Kabat-Zinn in his mindfulness-based stress reduction training, you know, took that as a completely non-sectarian, non-Buddhist approach to meditation that he started doing in Massachusetts General Hospital for people with stress and chronic pain. So it was called the mindfulness-based stress reduction and pain management course initially. And it starts with very gentle moving, so it's mindful movement through yoga. And one of the things that Jon Kabat-Zinn is saying now, especially for people who've had trauma, is that it's really not responsible to start somebody with a sitting meditation, but it's very important that people do mindful movement. And then it's also really important if people have had trauma not to simply sit and close their eyes and go in, because oftentimes what people will end up in is what Peter Levine calls a trauma vortex. So the mindfulness-based stress reduction, Jon Kabat-Zinn starts with the feet. And he starts with the left foot, and it's toe by toe. It's very specific. So it's a really directed mindfulness practice, and then it comes up the left leg, and then it comes up all the toes on the right foot, and it comes up the right leg, and then it goes through the body, and then it does the body as a whole. So that's directly from the Satipatthana Sutta, is, you know, mindfulness of the body and the parts of the body, and then the body as a whole. And then there's mindfulness of what the Buddha called the repulsiveness of the body, but that also equals the 32 parts of the body. I have to say, when I did it, what I experienced was awe. And that's the one that Bob taught, and it's, you just recite through head, hair, body, hair, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys. You go through all of the layers from the outside in, and then you go through the fluids of the body. And it was amazing in that it's a 10-month training where you keep doing that. And people had interesting healings and interesting experiences. I know one of the things that happened for me when I was doing that, because we kept doing, you would do head, hair, body, hair, nails, teeth, skin for like a week this way, and then you would do it backwards for a week, and then you would do it frontwards and backwards for a week. And at the end of the 10 months, because you kept, then you would add each one, so it was sort of like old MacDonald had a farm, you know, it just keeps adding on. And by the end of it, like, my hair was growing in better. I used to have really dry hair, and I always thought it was because my thoughts were so, my mind was so overheated that it just sort of cooked my hair on the top of my head. And by the end of it, it was like my hair was like glossy. It was the funniest thing. And I've also had changes in the quality of the toenails on my little toes were funny, and when I was doing the body scan, I could feel the beds of my capillary beds open, and then my toenails started growing in better. I mean, not everybody has that, but people were relating the most amazing kinds of improvements in parts of their body, because in Chinese medicine, they say where your awareness goes is where your energy goes, and where your energy goes is where your blood goes, and where your energy and your blood and your awareness go is where healing goes. So in terms of some of the medicine Buddha practices, this is all part of that tradition. And I just wanted to share something on the back of this. I don't know if you can see it very well, but these are pictures of the nerves, 32 billion parts of the body, given how many brain cells there are. But I guess I'll just pass this around, because it's just pictures of the nerves, and they look like the aurora borealis. They're just so gorgeous. This was a free online course from Duke University in medical neuroscience, and almost 45,000 people all over the world signed up for it. And I think there were only about 2,000 of us that made it all the way through. It was grueling. But what was so notable in it, there were something like 48 videos on the the sensory system alone, the sense of smell and the sense of sound. So there's all the sense gates. And then they showed us the way the nerves go from the eyes, the ears, the nose, the skin, how they go through the nerve endings up the spine to the brain, and they go through the brain stem, through the reptilian brain. Daniel Siegel has this great brain, this model. This is the FIST model of the brain. He's the MindSight interpersonal neurobiology guy. So as I was listening to that man, who clearly wasn't that little boy's father, but as they were negotiating their connection and the attunement, I was just thinking that's just such a beautiful contemplation on interpersonal neurobiology. They were really feeling each other out, and he was attuning to that little boy. And as we're attuned to, the infant requires that being seen and that attunement from the caregiver for certain aspects of our neurology to come online. One of the layers of suffering that we sometimes deal with, some of the suffering we have, we know what it is. We have memory of where it came from. That was a specific shock trauma, or somebody said something that hurt my feelings, or my dad left when I was 8, or, you know, there are things that are in memory. And there are other things that are, in terms of this interpersonal neurobiology, that are in what we call implicit memory, which means that there are things that happened that affected our senses and our sense of self that came in before we were old enough to have to give verbal description to what happened or to form a verbal memory of what happened. And so some of the things that we struggle with that are some of the most profound aspects of suffering really come in at that level of implicit memory. And it comes in, so this goes back to Daniel Siegel and some of what I wanted to share about the research, is that this is the reptilian brain, the old brain, and so it's the part that if you were a lizard and you saw a shadow fly over, you would scuttle off. That's how we orient to danger or orient to threat. And it has to do with our sense of safety in an environment. And that part of our brain is always scanning for that. And it's one of the reasons I think the Buddha said we need Sangha, is that Homo sapiens, having had this sort of being on the savanna, always has this sense of, I kind of need somebody to like watch my back. So in Sangha we have that, and I don't know if any of you have experienced that it's easier in some ways for your mind to settle when you meditate with other people than it might be at home alone. And some of that has to do with that kind of mammalian brain, that we're sort of tribal herd animals, and that part of the sense of safety comes from a group of us. So that sense of orienting to threat comes out of that old part of the brain. And then the emotional brain, which they're saying now the limbic system is kind of an outdated term, but it's sort of in the middle of the brain, and Daniel Siegel likens it to the thumb, and this is where the emotions are memories, and there are certain memories that if they happen in a way that was too much, too fast, too big, we were too little, a car accident's like that, everything happens all at once, it's very compressed. There are certain ways that the memory gets fragmented, so it's not a clear narrative, so the pieces of it are all jumbled and they're stored in different places, and the charge of it gets stored in a part of this limbic system, which is this midbrain that's called the amygdala. And I have a client that I do trauma work with, and she calls her Amy Gadala. So one of the things we're working on, because she's had this whole series of shock traumas, is unpacking things so that Amy doesn't have to carry them around, and we're getting them into the part of the brain that has a clear narrative memory from start to finish. But there are things that happen, like at the impact of a shock trauma, that you don't necessarily want to go back in and try to remember. You want to try and remember when you were okay, coming out of it and going into it, when you first kind of maybe noticed an uh-oh, but not to go directly, because that's where all of the charges in the amygdala is, like in that shock, and so there's really an art to working with those memories. But then the next thing that gets really interesting, and this is where the research into meditation and the brain has gotten really fascinating, is that the cortex, the neocortex, the newer part of the brain that's more the unique to human beings, is this part that's overlies, and it touches actually this reptilian brain, see where my fingers are, and it also touches the limbic system, which is where the thumb is. And the orbital medial prefrontal cortex, which is like this part that's tucked under here, it wraps around and it actually contacts physically in the brain the emotional limbic system and the reptilian fight-flight system. And so this, what we find is that through meditation, through concentration meditation and the jhanas, and meditating on that kind of happiness of the quiet mind and the mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of thinking and disidentifying from them, strengthens parts of this neocortex that actually contacts the emotional brain and the reptilian brain, and strengthens the connection to where it actually creates more resilience, less reactivity, slower, not as big, not as fast, not as long, and all of the cultivation of those states comes from the meditation practices. Is anybody familiar with the research that His Holiness the Dalai Lama is inspired? Have you run into the Mind and Life conferences? It's exciting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So the Dalai Lama, growing up in Tibet, one of the things that he grew up with were two old cars, a telescope, and a clock that were gifts to the 13th Dalai Lama. And Tibet was still very isolated when he was a boy. And the other thing he grew up with in the Tibetan cosmology is that the earth is flat and that the moon is its own source of light. And so not only from the time that he was three was he like trained in dialectics and debate and logic and all of the meditation practices, but he was fascinated by science. So he learned how to take the cars apart, and he learned how to take the clock apart and put it back together again. And he took the telescope up to the top of the Potala Palace, and he noticed that there were shadows on the moon, by which he logically deduced that the moon did not have its own source of light. And I can't remember whether there was some other calculation that he did that he realized that the earth was not flat, it was round. And at that point, he made this commitment in terms of whatever there was about Buddhism that was refuted by science, it needed to change. So then when he came to the West, he invited scientists to come into a dialogue with him. And you can go online, and the 26th Mind and Life Conference was this January, and you can get the YouTube recordings of some of the research that I'm going to talk about here. One of the ways that they were using it, and Matthieu Ricard is one of the people that they just ran him through a functional MRI, and they could see when he went into different types of meditation practices or no meditation practices, which side of his brain would light up. And so back to this prefrontal cortex, one of the things that they noticed with him was that when he was in compassion practice, that the right side of the brain and the left side of the brain, right, and they're different. Those hemispheres are really different. So what they've been able to determine or study is the right-left shift, which is that when we're experiencing afflictive emotions, the right side of the prefrontal cortex lights up in an fMRI. So the three poisons, the five hindrances, the aggregates, all of those things on all of the lists that we're invited to contemplate and to release, And so in the jhanas, the thing that happens when you're concentrated is that you're free of the five hindrances. So you're free of grasping, you're free of aversion, you're free of sloth and torpor, you're free of agitation, and you're free of doubt. So then when Mathurikar goes into either a non-doing kind of free-form meditation or a contemplation practice, they did, I think, three or four different states, and he wanted to say, all wanted to see how they were different. The left side of his prefrontal cortex lights up. And when the left side of the prefrontal cortex lights up, it has more effect on the amygdala, even though the amygdala and the hippocampus, those memory parts of the limbic system, are bilateral. It's the left side of the prefrontal cortex that's enhanced by the meditation practices that we do that strengthens the connection of the prefrontal cortex to stabilize the mind and to decrease the reactivity that's happening in that place where charged memories got packed away. It's really pretty fascinating how that all works. I just wanted to look up right-left shift and mindfulness. So what I found was a paper called The Neurobiology of Mindfulness. It was published in, it says mindfulness, and I don't know if it's a journal or if it's an online journal, but it was in 2008, and there are four studies to explain why mindfulness can be a powerful tool. And this was for the treatment of a number of psychiatric disorders. And so the first one is structural brain changes. And one of them is to a part of the brain that's on the inside. So if you imagine that your brain being divided as it is, like a walnut, you know, like the two sides of a walnut. So this is like the middle, the inside of one of the sides of your brain. Sorry, it's not bigger. What they say is that one of the structural changes is that the left insula, when people have done meditation, the right anterior insula is involved in the awareness of internal states and one's sense of self. So when I got to the part of this course that was talking about the insula, which is tucked in underneath your temporal lobe, so right in here, but underneath the part that has to do with speech, toward the middle, is where your sense of self is tucked away. Did anybody see the film The Little Buddha? It's a beautiful film, and it might be one that would be fun for us to show for Dharma Movie Night. And it's a story about a young boy, and the Tibetan scholars think that he's the incarnation of a tulku, so they're inviting him to come and take his role. And one of the things they tell is a story from a book called The Little Buddha. And it's about the sense of self and how the Buddha, in his enlightenment, encountered it in a new way for the first time. So in the story, a Hindu prince called Siddhartha sets on a journey to achieve his goal. Mara, they call him a jealous demon. This is a child story, but of course it's delusion. Senses that Siddhartha, and that's Keanu Reeves, is about to attain enlightenment and sends his daughters to distract him with sense pleasures, right? Failing to do so, he attempts to shatter Siddhartha's resolve and throws in an onslaught of threats, intimidation, and temptations. He summons a terrifying horde of monsters of every conceivable description, many of which we've run into on the cushion, right? But it leaves Siddhartha unmoved and unperturbed. Instead, he transforms the weapons which they throw at him into lotus petals, which exude a lovely fragrance as they gently float to earth. Mara decides that Siddhartha will not deny himself. And so Mara turns into Siddhartha's image in a reflection on a pool of water. Instead, Siddhartha reaches and pulls the image out of the water. And this is the dialogue between Mara and the Buddha. Mara, you who go where others dare not, will you be my god, the architect of my house? Siddhartha, finally I meet the illusion of self. Your evil house will not be built again. Mara, but you live in me, I am your house. Siddhartha, O trickster, phantom of my own ego, you are pure illusion, you self do not exist. There are Buddhas that you see where he's touching the ground. That is a statue of this moment when the Buddha touches the ground and says, "The earth is my witness to this supreme enlightenment." So essentially what the Buddha saw into was the sense of self constructed, we now know, in the insula. And we sort of have this sense now in terms of neuroscience about how the data from the senses goes in and it gets wired through all of these different parts of the brain to form the sense impressions that are influenced by our sense of self and by our history. So that neuroscience is saying what the Buddha said, which is that what we perceive isn't what's out there, it's the construction that our nervous system has created based on the sensory input, but as it's kind of gated and mitigated and tracked through all these different aspects of the nervous system that got it from the skin, from the eyes, from the ears, from the tongue, from the nose, up to the brain where it gets filtered and then it gets reconstructed in an image of both the outer world and then the self that's experiencing the world. So for me, it was so exciting to just take this course. And the person who was teaching the course spoke about mindfulness and the mind a lot. And it turns out that one of the people at Duke University is a philosopher of consciousness. And I thought this Leonard White, the guy who taught the course, had to have talked to, I forgot his name, I meant to get it tonight, but that philosopher of consciousness has been he's been the philosopher that's been part of the Mind and Life conferences with the Dalai Lama. So they always have a philosopher, they have a neuroscientist, they have all of these different people. I don't want to go too much longer, but I just want to just cite Richie Davidson. Richard Davidson's one of the main people, and he has a laboratory for effective neuroscience at the University of Wisconsin. He's the one that ran Matthieu Ricard through the functional MRI to discover the right-left shift. We call it now asymmetrical prefrontal cortical activation. Here's a little chart of it. You know, so you can do this in a very scientific way to show the right-left shift created by meditation. And this is how mindfulness gets experience out of your amygdala and back into your hippocampus. This is the science of how this works. It's pretty fun. And this is another picture of the medial prefrontal cortex and how it gets things that these little orange dots are where your amygdala is. And then how you get things to where the amygdala calms down, and you can see how you would go from what's happening in depression and specific mindfulness practices that really shift the way those parts of the brain are functioning to begin to bring the brain back out of whatever's firing in a depressed way and into ways that begin to give us the jhana states of freedom from the hindrances, freedom from clinging and all of those things, and back into that happiness that Analia was talking about, which is really sort of our birthright and the capacity that our mind has when you get into the what mind really is. There's all kinds of fun stuff that if you want to know, I'm happy to share.